For the rest of this hour, the campaign issue that, well, sort of is, sort of isn't, the environment. According to a recent Gallup poll, 62% of voters rate a candidate's position on the environment as extremely important or very important in deciding whom to vote for. So can environmental issues influence the way voters make their choices at the polls this November? And if so, what are those choices? The rest of the hour, we're going to be talking and looking at environmental policies and issues this year with two people of opposing views. And I invite you to join our conversation. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. is a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. His new book is Crimes Against Nature, How George W. Bush and His Corporate Pals Are Plundering the Country and Hijacking Our Democracy, just out by HarperCollins. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Jonathan H. Adler. He's Associate Professor of Law and Associate Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University. He's also a contributing editor at National Review Online, and he joins us from Member Studio WCPN in Cleveland. Thank you for talking with us today, Professor.
Good to be here.
Mr. Kennedy, did you hear anything in the President's speech last night about the environment that caused your ears to pick up?
No, I didn't. He doesn't talk much about the environment. President Bush, and I have to say this, that as I say in my book, I've been very disciplined over 20 years as an environmental advocate about being nonpartisan and bipartisan on these issues. I don't think there's any such thing as Republican children or Democratic children. I think the worst thing that could happen to this issue is if it becomes the province of a single political party. But you can't talk honestly about the environment today in any context without talking critically about this president. This is the worst environmental president we've had in our history. If you go to NRDC's website, the Natural Resource Defense Council, you can see over 400 major environmental rollbacks that have been either promoted or implemented by this administration during the last 3.5 years. And it's a concerted, deliberate attack, an attempt to eviscerate 30 years of environmental law.
Dr. Adler, any comment?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that this administration has not made environmental policy a major issue, and the president is unlikely to talk about it a lot during the campaign. But I don't think it is fair or accurate to characterize this administration as waging a war on the environment. Some of the things that are characterized by Mr. Kennedy and by NRDC as major rollbacks are things like this administration deciding to regulate something that Clinton had proposed to regulate, but simply not as much. So, for example, one example in the book and on NRD's website is energy efficiency standards for new air conditioners. The Clinton administration proposed requiring a 30% reduction in energy use or 30% increase in energy efficiency. The Bush administration went ahead with new regulations, but by not as much. Calling something like that a major rollback, and most of them are of that nature, is simply not accurate. This administration is certainly not regulating as aggressively as a Gore administration would have, and I would certainly agree it has done little to try and advance alternative approaches to environmental protection. But I don't think we serve the debate or the discussion of environmental policy by characterizing this administration as somehow being on an anti-environmental rampage.
Robert Kennedy, any response?
Yeah, first of all, I would say that if you look at those rollbacks, anybody can look at this. Go to NRDC's website. By no means are most of them regulations that were proposed by the administration and by the Clinton administration and then rolled back or not implemented by this administration. But even in those cases where they are, like the cases that Professor Adler just mentioned, you have to understand that it takes, on average, 8 years to promulgate an environmental regulation. So many of these regulations were regulations that EPA had been working on through two administrations and finally got to an agreement. And these agreements are the product of compromise with industry. They're the product of rigorous public debate. And they got to the point near the end of the administration in many cases, but they weren't fully promulgated or published. And then the Bush administration froze all those regulations. Andrew Carr did the day the president was inaugurated, and the vast majority of them were either derailed completely or rolled back to a point where they're absolutely ineffectual. But again, that is not the majority of the list of over 400 on NRDC's website. If you look at this list, what you can see is that if even a fraction of the current laws and legal changes that are proposed by the Bush administration are implemented by this time, you know, next year, we will effectively have no significant federal environmental law left in our country. That's not exaggeration.
And that's just simply not true.
That is not hyperbole. It is a fact. Many of our laws will remain on the books in one form or the other, but they'll be unenforceable. And, you know, we'll be like Mexico, which has these wonderful poetic environmental laws, but nobody knows about them, and nobody complies with them because they can't be enforced.
I think that's an exaggeration. It's certainly accurate to say that this administration has not regulated as aggressively as many environmental groups would like. And no one who supported the president in his election effort in 2000 expected him to regulate as much as a Gore administration would have. And in some states, that certainly worked to his benefit. But to say that we will be without federal environmental regulation, it's just simply not the case. Most federal environmental statutes can be enforced through citizen suits, and I know Mr. Kennedy has been involved in filing citizen suits. Most of the regulations will remain on the books and will remain enforceable, and the statutes themselves are not being removed. What is at issue here is this administration willing to continue the same sort of command and control regulation that prior administrations have? It hasn't.
Okay.
I think that's a good thing. I think the bad thing is that it hasn't put forward an alternative, and I think that's a valid thing to criticize this administration
for. My alternative is we have to go to a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're talking about the environment as an election year issue this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. My guests, Jonathan Adler, Associate Professor of Law, Associate Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve, also a contributing editor at National Review Online. Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. His new book, Crimes Against Nature, published by HarperCollins. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Professor Adler, you said that the administration is not putting out alternatives or not being very, proactive in telling people about its position on the environment. And I know we even called the White House looking for someone to come on the program. They wouldn't even return our phone call. Can you make the case for the administration?
Well, I mean, I think I can make the case for some of the things the administration has done. There are other things that the administration has done or not done that I think it deserves criticism for. One area where Mr. Kennedy and I would almost certainly agree is the energy bill, which I don't think makes a lot of sense economically or environmentally, and I'm fairly certain Mr. Kennedy agrees with me on that. But there are areas where this administration is trying to do a greater job of involving state and local governments and other stakeholders in the decision-making process, and I think that's a long overdue change in environmental policy. There are other areas where the administration has taken the right position, but unfortunately has not invested much political capital in moving the ball forward, and I think the best example of that involves fisheries, where this administration recognizes the sorts of regulatory changes that are necessary to have both economically and environmentally sustainable fisheries, but unfortunately has not invested any political capital in making those changes happen.
And, what kind of changes are you talking about?
Move towards what's essentially a property-based regulatory system that's usually referred to as individual fishing quotas or IFQs, sometimes called ITQs. Most of the major environmental groups that work on this issue support this type of change. It's been incredibly effective in countries like New Zealand and Iceland and in the handful of U.S. fisheries where they were implemented before Congress adopted a moratorium. The moratorium has expired. This administration is on record supporting a shift towards greater use of IFQs, but unfortunately it is not paying much attention to the issue and not moving the ball forward. So I would say this is a good example of the administration knowing what to be against. It recognizes that business as usual, trying to regulate fisheries the way we have in the past, doesn't work, doesn't protect fisheries from exploitation and from depletion, but is not, for a variety of reasons, has not been willing to take the next step of actually putting forward something which would be an environmental improvement and advance the ball forward and reform the policy.
Can I just go ahead? One of the things that Professor Adler suggested that maybe I might be overstating when I said that this could abolish, that the current initiatives by the Bush administration could actually effectively abolish most significant environmental law. Let me just give you one example. One of the initiatives that they're promoting is what's called takings legislation, and that legislation is very deceptive. It pretends to protect people's property rights, but actually it's a way of protecting the right of people to pollute. It's a way of giving constitutional protection to the right to pollute, of allowing people to use their property to destroy their neighbor's property and destroy the public property. And what that law would do, and it's called a super mandate, is it would force, it would say that the federal government cannot regulate pollution unless it first pays the polluters to comply with the law. Well, if we had to pay people not to do bad things on their property, you couldn't print enough money. Government would cease to exist. But that's what the law, it would abolish in one fell swoop, literally all federal environmental law, because government couldn't afford to pay people not to burn toxics into the air or not to fill wetlands or not to put pollutants into the waterways. So the other thing that he said was that the good thing that the Bush administration is doing is returning control to the states. But that's exactly what the federal environmental laws were passed in 1970, because it wasn't working. Because what happens is you get a race to bottom where the states lower their environmental standards to recruit polluters and to get some short-term pollution-based prosperity, but all of our country pays the debt. And let me just give you an example from the Hudson River. Back in the 60s, General Electric Company came into the Hudson Valley to poverty-stricken towns in upstate New York, Fort Edward and Hudson's Falls, and said to the town fathers, we're going to build you a spanking new factory. We're going to bring in 1,500 new jobs. We're going to raise your tax base. All you have to do is waive your environmental laws and let us dump our toxic PCBs into the Hudson River. And if you don't do it, we'll move to New Jersey, and we'll do it from over there, and they'll get the jobs and the taxes, but you'll still get the PCBs. Fort Edwards and Hudson Falls took the bait. 2 decades later, GE closed those factories. They fired the workers. They left the Hudson Valley with their pockets stuffed with cash, the richest corporation in the history of mankind. They left behind a $2 billion cleanup bill that nobody in the Hudson Valley can afford. I represent 1,000 commercial fishermen who have lost their jobs because although the Hudson is loaded with fish, the fish are still loaded with General Electric's PCBs. The barge traffic on the river is dried up because the shipping channels are too toxic to dredge. All of that beautiful shoreline property that was occupied by General Electric's factories with tax breaks from the grateful localities is now permanently off the tax rolls, robbed from those communities as a source of revenue and recreation. And every woman between Oswego and Albany has elevated levels of PCB in her breast milk. And everybody in the Hudson Valley has General Electric's PCBs in our flesh and in our organs. I have triple the levels, the national average of PCBs in my organ, because I live in the Hudson Valley. And that is, the federal laws were meant to end that kind of corporate blackmail and to stop these corporations from coming in and whipsawing one community in New York against another in New Jersey to get them to race to bottom, to lower their environmental standards, to recruit these filthy industries in exchange for the promise of a few years of pollution-based prosperity and to ransom their children's futures in the process. This local control that the White House often talks about, states' rights and local control, it sounds good on paper, but the real outcome of that devolution will not be local control. It will be corporate control, because these large multinationals can so easily dominate the state political landscapes.
I don't think either of those claims is empirically accurate. Just first on takings legislation, this administration is making no serious effort to get takings legislation adopted. Takings legislation has not been debated in Congress for about 6 years. I testified on the last legislation that was proposed, and all of the takings legislation that was proposed was designed to codify existing legal precedent, cases primarily out of the Court of Claims and Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And secondly, always included a nuisance exception or a clear exception for cases in which a property owner was seeking to engage in an activity that would harm a neighbor. So the idea that this would somehow affect pollution control legislation is simply not true, and that's clear when that legislation, again 6 years ago, before this administration was elected, was reported out of committee The legislative history made that very, very clear. On the issue of decentralization, first of all this administration has said is that state and local governments and other stakeholders, including environmental groups, need a bigger place at the table, and private landowners as well need a bigger place at the table when it comes to land use decisions. It's not talking about devolving regulatory authority. What that means in practice is that when the federal government is making a decision on, say, how to handle BLM land or Forest Service land in a state where there is extensive amounts of such land, and we often forget that about half of the land west of the Mississippi is owned by the federal government, that the communities and the individuals that are affected by those land use decisions should have a greater say in what goes on because it affects them. In some states, that may mean increased amounts of timber cutting or increased amounts of grazing, but in other states, and a good example of this is New Mexico under Governor Bill Richardson, that will clearly lead to greater levels of protection. More broadly, we see today states around the nation consistently regulating more extensively than the federal government, trying to go even further but often being precluded by the federal government. And there was a case from the Supreme Court just this last year pointing out that much of federal legislation can preempt states from trying new things that will do a better job of meeting the environmental demands of their citizens. And that's a pattern we've seen. And historically, and this is the best example, historically, some of the federal legislation that we have was explicitly adopted to prevent states from adopting more stringent standards. And the example that has been most well documented is with federal vehicle emission controls, where California was the first state to adopt controls on new vehicles. Other states were beginning to look at that as well. And the automakers decided that they would rather have a long drawn out regulatory process in Washington, D.C., resulting in a single national standard, than risking different states doing different things. So the idea that removing power from Washington, D.C. necessarily advances corporations' interests or is necessarily something that big business wants just simply isn't accurate. You know, it's both not accurate in terms of what the administration is doing, and even if the administration did go further, that's not the sort of effect we'd be likely to see.
And let me go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Ed in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Hi, Ed.
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
Well, the topic that you're talking about right now is of very much importance and interest to the local citizens in Jackson. If anyone's been to Grand Teton National Park or Yellowstone, they can understand the wildness and ruggedness that's out here. And just recently, the local, I don't know what her title is, but maybe director of the Bridger Teton National Forest is having some troubles right now because the Forest Service is about to open up about 175,000 acres to additional oil and gas leasing. Of this 175,000 acres, 92,000 are currently those 92,000 currently lie in inventoried roadless areas. And by opening it up to leasing, they will contradict the area being roadless because the companies will have to come in and put roads in and really open up more human interaction into these areas. So when looking at this issue from a political one, does it strike the voters in any way about, you know, who they're going to vote for in November? I'd say that from a perspective out west, it's very important to us what direction that our national lands are going.
Do you think it's going to be an issue there?
I think it already is. In fact, the town meeting that we just had last week, and it was written up in the local newspaper, it was standing room only. And so they're really at odds. In fact, one member in the audience had asked if the director received any direction from Washington, D.C. And she said that, yes, she did receive some direction from D.C., but stressed that the leasing is part of her agency's mission. And it's not just a black and white issue, as maybe I'm portraying it, but it is a difficult one. There's a lot of layers involved and studies that need to be done.
All right, Ed.
But,
thanks.
It's a very tough one.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's talk about a little bit about global warming. Did the president not say in 2000 when he was running that he was going to do something about carbon dioxide emissions? Dr. Adler. And what has happened with that?
Well, he did say in one speech and in one position paper that was put on his website that CO2 would be one of the substances regulated by. When they increased regulation of power plant emissions. And the administration has backed away from that and decided that the costs of that, particularly given the concerns about energy security and energy reliability and supply that the administration focused on in its first few years in office, that was not something it wanted to go ahead with at this time. And you know, I don't think that is something that is a major surprise. Bush, when he was campaigning, made very clear he was not going to support the Kyoto Protocol, made very clear that those sorts of policies would be actively opposed by his administration.
And he's still not willing to admit, even though his own government, his own bureaucracy, as he calls it, has said that global warming is caused by human endeavor. He still doesn't want to buy that.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that's quite accurate. He's made a couple comments relating to it back in 2001. I know that he made comments about, you know, the evidence certainly supports that human activity is the primary source of increased CO2 in the atmosphere. This administration doesn't believe that adopting binding limits on emissions makes much sense. I think the administration is correct that given current technologies, such approaches would impose significant economic costs but do nothing to mitigate threats of climate change. And so therefore, pursuing that sort of strategy doesn't make a lot of sense. And in the academic literature, that's not a particularly a controversial view. There are lots of folks in the environmental policy range that do not believe that adopting command and control regulations for carbon dioxide makes sense at this time.
But they do believe that—let me just remind everybody, I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. But they do accept the fact that global warming is man-made.
I think most people accept, and I
the president still doesn't want to admit that, even though his own scientists are telling him that, for political reasons.
I haven't seen what the president recently has or hasn't said.
I'll find the quote for you if you'd like. Let me get a comment from Robert Kennedy.
Well, we have a president who says the jury's still out on evolution. It's hard to believe what kind of evidence we'd need to muster in order to convince him that global warming does exist. The oil industry, the coal industry, employs these phony, aberrant scientists. We call them biostitutes, the same kind of people that the Tobacco Institute used to hire. And the tobacco industry, using this methodology, was able to insulate itself from regulation for 60 years, even though everybody knew that it was killing one out of every five of its customers that used its product as directed. The coal industry and the oil industry have a lot more money at stake, and they're the people surrounding the president. They are, with the exception of some companies like BP and Shell that have said, yes, this is a very, very grave economic threat to the global human population. The industries in our country, Exxon and Mobil and some of the others, are still trying to surreptitiously at least make the case that global warming doesn't exist. And they've been able to persuade a large chunk of the American public using these phony scientists that there actually is some doubt out there. I want to say this about what Mr. Adler said. All of the things that we need to do to solve the problem with global warming or to mitigate the problem with global warming are things we ought to be doing anyway to benefit our economy. This is not going to impose an economic cost on our nation. The first thing, of course, we ought to be doing is improving fuel efficiency. If we improve fuel efficiency in our automobiles by 1 mile per gallon, it's 2 Arctic National Wildlife Refuges full of oil. If we improve it by 8 miles per gallon, it's all the oil from the Persian Gulf that we could eliminate. That would enrich our country. It would make us more prosperous. It would make us less dependent on Mideastern dictators who despise democracy, who are hated by their own people, and who have now entangled us in this war that has cost us the affection and respect of the world, along with the human treasure that we've lost and $200 billion from our treasury. All of us would be richer if we had cars that were more fuel efficient. I drive a minivan, 22 mile per gallon minivan. If I had a car that got 40 miles per gallon, which is certainly within the easy technological achievement, I would have $1,000 in my pocket at the end of the year. And you remember when President Bush sent us all a $300 check and said, you know, this is an economic stimulus package. Well, what if every American, and I had to gut the Social Security fund in the process to do it, what if every American were getting hundreds or thousands of dollars a year from fuel savings? What would that do to stimulate our economy? The things that we need to do in order to reduce carbon emissions are things we ought to be doing anyway. And the Germans are doing it, and the Japanese are doing it, and they're developing the technologies, and now they own those technologies. We developed the technology for hybrid cars in our country, but now we had no use for them, and the Japanese now own the patent, and they're selling them back to Ford, leasing them back to Ford to build its new SUV. So, you know, the technologies that are going to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and reduce emissions of carbon gases are the technologies that we will be able to market to stimulate those, the development of those technologies, is something that's going to be good for our balance of payment, and it's going to insulate us from price shocks on the international oil market. It's good for our country.
All right, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Jonathan Adler after this. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the environment and its possible role as an issue this year in the election. Our number, 1-800-999-8255. My guest, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. His new book is Crimes Against Nature, How George W. Bush and His Corporate Pals Are Plundering the Country and Hijacking Our Democracy. Also, Dr. Jonathan Adler, Associate Professor of Law, Associate Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Steve in Salt Lake City. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to follow up on the global warming issue. I do remember when President Bush said something regarding how global warming was a real phenomenon, but that we would just try and insulate ourselves from the effects as opposed to try to prevent its occurrence. And I frankly think that's a fairly immoral position when we have 5% of the emissions and, I'm sorry, 5% of the population and 25% of the CO2 emissions. And frankly, it would be most of the rest of the world that would experience global warming's most serious effects.
Right, Steve, hang on. Gentlemen, is the environment, global warming, are these issues going to play a role in this election, or is it going, you know, I listened to Senator Kerry last night. He brings it up, the environment, up as an issue in passing every on his stump speech. Do you think it's going to have any traction?
I think it depends on the press. The problem isn't with John Kerry. The problem is that the press won't cover these issues. In fact, if you read Paul Krugman's article 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, he did an analysis of the press covering the substance of any of the debates and found that they simply aren't doing it. They'll cover the red states versus the green states, the fistfight aspects of the election, but they're not covering, and the polling, but they're not covering the actual substantive differences. And that's, you know, one of the mistakes that the press made when they covered the Iraq war is that they really didn't look at the claims of the White House. The public is very interested in these issues, both Republican and Democrat. The latest Gallup poll shows that 81% of Republicans want stronger environmental laws and they want them strictly enforced. The same is true in the Democratic Party. If people knew that this attack on the environment was occurring, they would be indignant, and it would certainly play a role in the way many of them vote. And I see this when I'm out on the hustings. I speak publicly probably 200 days a year, and mostly to Republican groups, and they're as indignant as Democrats about what's happening when they're informed of it. The problem is nobody knows that this is happening for two reasons. One is that the Bush White House has mounted a stealth attack on the environment after receiving the advice to do so from his pollster Frank Luntz in a memo that we released to the press 2 years ago. But also the American media has been negligent about covering this issue and has abetted the stealth attack by the White House. They are simply not covering it. And I've talked to John Kerry about this issue and said, you've got to talk more because it's a huge vulnerability for the White House. And what he said is the same thing that Al Gore said to me 4 years ago and Bob Shrum said to me 4 years ago, is we are talking about it, but we can't get traction. Nobody will cover it.
I would just say, I mean, I don't think that the issue is that clear cut. First, in terms of the political impact, there was a very good article in the Washington Post about a week or so ago pointing out that when it comes to environmental issues, concerns vary greatly from place to place. And while there are some parts of the country represented perhaps by the caller from earlier that want to see increased levels of environmental regulation, there are other parts of the country where advocating increased environmental regulation is going to be very damaging for a candidate. And two good examples of that, one of them is in West Virginia, where certainly those who work in the coal industry are very concerned about the prospect of increased regulation of coal. And in Michigan, where fuel efficiency standards that Mr. Kennedy's think should be increased, and certainly Senator Kerry thinks should be increased. That's not very popular with auto workers. It's not very popular given the effect historically that's had on the automobile industry. And I would say from a policy standpoint, to address what was said before, it's really unclear that CAFE standards are this wonderful free lunch. First of all, CAFE standards, 8 miles a gallon, they could be 20 miles per gallon higher than they are today. They would not make a dent in terms of atmospheric concentrations of CO2 and greenhouse gases. Full compliance with Kyoto globally doesn't make a dent in future projections of climate change. And on top of that, we already know that most European nations aren't going to meet their Kyoto targets anyway.
But they're going to drive much more fuel-efficient cars.
They might, but there's two things here.
There were stories
to point
about one, China, whatever, are going to order these cars that the American car makers can't make for them.
And American automakers tend to make the cars that they think are going to sell, and I certainly don't usually think it's a good idea or very efficient for the government to second guess those whose money's on the line about what's actually going to sell. But in terms of the actual effects of fuel economy standards, the National Academy of Sciences pointed out that existing fuel economy standards have resulted in an increase of thousands of highway fatalities because it produced vehicle downsizing and lower weight and less crash space. And so increasing CAFE standards would be likely to have a similar effect. And in terms of energy security, the reason we import so much oil from overseas is because it's less expensive. If you reduce on the margins U.S. oil consumption, what you primarily do is drive down domestic production. So while we might be using overall less oil, the percentage that comes from overseas would actually increase if we had a 4 or 5 or 8 miles per gallon increase in fuel economy standards, and that's not controversial. Oil's
a commodity. Why not invest in alternative forms of energy that would take, in the long run, just wean us away from oil? Any dependence on foreign fuel?
Two things. Well, one, I mean, autarky in commodities is economically suicidal. But
isn't that the role of government to set the direction and the standard? The
government does a very poor job of picking winners and losers. We've seen the government try and do this in the automobile area with things like the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, and in the 70s we saw it with things like the Synfuels program.
President Carter was able to stimulate the use of conservation, all the conservation techniques we put today as insulation in our homes that we now consider to be standard. He was the one who...
Primarily a result of energy prices.
Yes, go ahead.
Can I say something
sure.
about this? First of all, of course, the government has a role, and the auto industry oftentimes resists. But when public health and safety and our national security is at stake, of course government has the role. You know, the auto industry resisted airbags. They resisted seatbelts. Those are very, very popular, and they remain popular. The problem is that we don't, you know, government already has picked a winner here. And the winner is essentially the oil industry. We give $65 billion worth of subsidies, direct subsidies to the oil industry, plus another $80 billion in protecting their pipelines in the Mideast every year. Those subsidies allow them to artificially lower the price of gasoline, which to, you know, whatever it is now, $2.25 a gallon. If we were paying the true price of gasoline, which we are, but we're paying it in taxes, if we were paying it at the pump, consumers would be screaming at Detroit to give us 40-mile-per-gallon cars. And guess what? Detroit would be making SUVs and cars with the same performance, the same size, the same safety as they're making today. However, they would get 40 miles per gallon. The market is distorted because of subsidies to the oil industry. And government has to step in, as they did during World War II, and as they have in many other cases, and said, wait a second, to this industry. You have to act responsibly to our country and to future generations. You can't do something that is killing people, that is making us dependent on these foreign dictators, and that is poisoning our air. It's a limited resource, and we're going to regulate there. I remember when I was dealing on the fisheries issues in the Pacific Northwest, or the Atlantic Northeast and the Canadian Maritimes, that the fishing industry, the big corporations who are making all the money catching these fish, said, you know, they'd say again and again, well, you know, people want to eat fish. We have to catch every fish in the ocean. Well, no, government does have a role. And the role is to say there's a limited resource here. It's part of the commons. It's part of, it's not private property. It's part of the commons, the shared commonwealth, which is those things that are not susceptible to private ownership, the air that we breathe, the water, the fisheries, the wandering animals. And one of government's primary roles is to regulate the commons to make sure there's enough for everybody and to live up to our trustee obligations to the next generation. And we've got to do that with our air as well. And for that reason, government does have to step in if we're going to continue. I believe in the free market. There's no stronger advocate for free market capitalism than myself. And I believe every act of pollution is a failure of the free market because of a subsidy. It's the result of a suspension of free market rules. And in this case, people acting by market stimulus would make the right decision if the market were completely left alone. But subsidies that the government is giving to the oil industry have distorted the marketplace, which has created this pollution by the automobile industry. And so government has to step in and force the automobile manufacturers to behave responsibly. And guess what? In the long run, it's going to be good for them, because the same way that seatbelts were and airbags were, they'll be dragged kicking and screaming, but they are going to lose the markets to Toyota and to the European manufacturers who are already doing all of these things and who are stealing our market from us.
Talking about the environment this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two before we have to go.
If I could just really quickly. I mean, first of all, I mean, on gasoline, I mean, Mr. Kennedy and I would agree that at least for certain industries, energy subsidies should be eliminated. I think they should be eliminated across the board. Government does a poor job of picking winners and losers. That's better done in the marketplace. But gasoline is already significantly taxed at both the state and federal level. And it's interesting when we're talking about the political impact of these issues. One of the things Senator Kerry has been talking about repeatedly on the stump is that oil prices are too high. And I think that's particularly disingenuous if he represents the position that we need to pay the so-called true price of gasoline at the pump. You can't have it both ways. Yep. And I would note several environmental groups have been doing this as well. They used to support higher energy taxes, but now because there's political advantage to saying so, they're complaining about high energy prices.
All right, let me see if I can get a quick phone call in. Amy in Maryland. Hi, Amy, quickly.
Hi. I just have a comment. I'm finding it very hard to reconcile the disconnect and the irony of the Republican Party, which is the party of the religious right, also being the party that's doing more to allow corporations to pollute the earth they believe God to have created. And it angers me to see the Bush administration waving a cross with one hand while the other hand's giving a permit, essentially, to corporate polluters to harm God's creatures. And I just wish people would be talking about that more.
I'd like to comment on that. And I have a chapter about that in my book about the religious right and the role that the religious right has played, the so-called religious right, which is really a Christian heresy known as dominion theology that was kind of espoused first by James Watt and Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and Sun Myung Moon, who is the owner of the Washington Times and has been one of the primary purveyors of the anti-environmental movement and primary funders. And, there are so many mandates in every religious tradition that God has given us this earth as stewards, that we are to take care of it, that this is where mandates that we study nature to know God. We don't know Michelangelo by reading his biography, but by looking at the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And in every religious tradition, the central epiphany always occurs in the wilderness. Muhammad had to go into the wilderness to have the Quran squeezed out of him. Buddha had to go into the wilderness to discover his higher consciousness. Christ had to spend 40 days in the wilderness to discover his divinity. Moses had to go to the wilderness of Mount Sinai to get the commandments, etc. And we, these are the same people who claim to embrace the values of religion and Christianity who are advocating this destruction of our natural resources. Ironically, it's the same people who are who publicly say they love the free market, but are advocating corporate welfare, capitalism for the poor, but socialism for the rich, which almost always results in environmental destruction. And the American people have to understand that there is a huge difference between free market capitalism, which enriches our people, which makes us prosperous, which democratizes our country, and the kind of corporate crony capitalism that this White House has espoused and embraced, which is as antithetical to democracy in America as it is in Nigeria.
Right. I have to give you the last word on that. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank my guests, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. His new book is Crimes Against Nature, How George Bush and His Corporate Pals Are Plundering the Country, Hijacking Our Democracy, just out by HarperCollins. Jonathan H. Adler, associate professor of law, associate director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to talk with us this hour. Have a good
weekend.
Have a good holiday. Our program is produced by Annette High senior producer Karen Berghoff. Charles Berquist is our web producer and our director. And we had help today from Jeff Carlton in Cleveland. Surf over to our website. Leave us some mail there. Also, back editions of Science Friday. And when school starts heating up next week, Science Friday's Kids Connection will be back. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.